walking through the silver stream. And she whispered words like he never heard that made him all shadow inside. And she said, "Wick, wham, bam, gonna make him a man. Wham, bam, bam, gonna get you if I can. Wick, wham, bam, gonna make him a man. Try a little touch, try a little too much. Try a little wick, wham, bam." Run in bed, didn't care about a little white dove and a tender love, till she took him to the silver stream. And she whispered words like he never heard that made him all weak inside. And she said, "Wick, wham, bam, gonna make him a man. Wham, bam, bam, gonna get you a bear if I can. Wick, wham, bam, gonna make him a man. Try a little touch, just try a little too much. Just try a little weak wham bam. Try a little weak wham bam. Wicka bama lama, wicka wama bama la, wicka wama bama la. Weak wham bam."
Yeah, that was a piece I made in 1973 when I was 10, and I'm singing "Weak Wham Bam, Gonna Make You My Man."
So, I'm in the South London Gallery with Tracy Emin in her exhibition, which is titled "I Need Art Like I Need God." And I think, let's start there, Tracy. The title, what does it mean? How does it relate to the works we're going to talk about?
I need art like I need God. Basically, that's a declaration to myself. And about a couple of years ago, I was down in Margate, walking along the beach, and I had a piece of chalk. And instead of writing some sort of usual graffiti thing, I actually wrote, "I need art like I need God." And at that moment, I realised that it was probably the truest statement I'd ever made to myself.
Do you use the term God in any specific religious sense, or is it just a general idea of an omnipotent person and power?
It's a general idea. I mean, basically, I could have put, I need art like I need love, I need art like I need faith, I need art like I need to save my soul, I need art. There could have been many things, but God is like universal. Everybody knows what it means, and it's a very short, sharp word which explains a lot of things to a lot of people immediately.
But as a symbol of something that is all good and is a positive force in relation to individuals?
Yes. Yeah, of course, God is perceived to be positive, not negative.
Shall we look at the works more or less in the order that they appear on this sort of handwritten, photostated three or four sheets that you've prepared as a kind of mini-guide to the exhibition? So the first work that we're going to look at then is titled Tacy Min, which is an Ouija board with a glass and two chairs either side. And what are the references to this?
Well, when I was little, my mum and everyone always used to do like the Ouija board or seances, and it was just like something every weekend. That's what they used to do. And the other week I was having a conversation with my mum, and we were looking at this chair. We've got a very nice 70s white formica table, and she would do the Ouija board on it. This glass would really, you know, go fast on it. And I asked her where I was at the time, and she said that I used to sit underneath the table. So for me to recreate a Ouija board is like just quite an obvious thing from my childhood. And the red velvet chair, that actually comes from the Theatre Royal in Margate, which is a haunted theatre. And the other chair comes from my home, which I've been sitting on for years. And the multicoloured cardigan belonged to a woman called Vi Player. Whatever, she's dead now. And then the drawings underneath are my drawings of the dead. There's about 15 of them, where I blindfolded myself in my museum, got very drunk, and thought about all the dead people that I knew, and then just tried to see what kind of drawings would occur. It was quite scary, actually. And the reason why the work's called Tacy Min is because when we were in, this originally was called Can You Hear Me? And then when I actually showed something similar when we were in Canada, some friends and I were doing the Ouija board, and it actually came out as Tacy Min, the words. And what's quite interesting about this, there isn't an E or an R on the board with the alphabet. For some reason I forgot them, and I haven't bothered putting them back in.
Spirituality and mysticism are two things you kind of refer to now and again. Which seems to me to be almost contrary, perhaps, to another way of describing your work, which is that of direct experience, of taking ideas and material from your personal experience, very practical day-to-day trials and tribulations of living. Is there a way in which the two things combine?
Yeah, I think so, because like at all moments. I mean, you can just be walking down the street and you can look at the clouds or the sky, or you can close your eyes for a moment and you can have like the most profound feelings. You don't have to be in some heightened spiritual state in some kind of small chapel on the edge of a mountain. It can happen to you anywhere, and I think daily life and spirituality should actually be much closer together, really.
It's quite interesting as you talk, in that not many artists, younger artists, actually talk about the areas of spirituality. It's as though, yes, they do deal with the kind of brashness of everyday life and their experiences, but it rarely encompasses this sort of metaphysical world.
Yeah, I think that's because my influences in art, for example, come from the beginning of the 19th century, 20th century. You know, they didn't come from the 1970s, for example. I just come from, my mind in art comes from a completely different era, a different time, when people were more romantically charged up, were more passionate, were more spiritual about things. And I've always been like it. And I'm not ashamed of it either, so hence I need art like I need God.
So you talk about being affected, perhaps, or influenced by more late 19th century, early 20th century ideas and thinking, as opposed to, say, the 70s. But can you be a bit more specific about which artists, which periods?
Well, like, for example, I really like Ibsen, the playwright. Edvard Munch's my favourite painter. Egon Schiele, my favourite drawer. I actually quite like Nietzsche a lot, even though I'm slightly ashamed to admit that, because I'm not exactly a rampant young boy or anything. And I just like all the passion behind it. And like Edvard Munch, for example, people said that he was a misogynist and things, but his actual titles for his paintings and the way he thought were actually very feminine and very to do with the spirit and to do with nature, all those kind of things. So,
and a kind of emotional intensity that is there in that work.
Well, I'm really emotional, but I think my work actually looks a lot calmer than I am. Yeah.
Let's move to another piece here. Now we're just at the edge of this work, which I believe is called Swedish Room, Exorcisms of the Last Painting I Ever Made. It's an installation, and it's a reconstruction of a space in a gallery in Stockholm, which you occupied last year, and I believe you more or less closed yourself into this room and painted naked, but people could kind of look in through small holes in the wall.
Yeah, there was about 12 peepholes down one wall and 8 on another, so there wasn't actually anywhere I could go in the room where I could be private. And I was naked as well. I mustn't forget that. Do you want to go inside it? Okay.
Can I, before we talk about the contents of the room, can you talk about why you were naked in it?
Well, first thing is, it's called Exorcism. The project was called Exorcism, the last painting I ever made. And because all the art stuff's going really well, the sewing things were going good, the sculptures, the writing, I was happy with art. The only thing that really did my head in was the painting thing. It just completely fucked me up whenever I thought about paint. And this is because in 1990, when I was pregnant, I stopped painting, then I stopped making art for a couple of years, which I've already explained to you. And everything started to go so well for me apart from the painting. So I decided that I'd go to Sweden and do this painting project, and if I could make one good painting, then I would have forgiven myself for the terminations and for giving up art and for all my failures. So that's the most important thing with this room. That's why it doesn't matter if the paintings aren't so good or if things look shit. It was about my experience, the transformation for me at the time.
Right. Well, we'll talk a bit about some of the films, and one of them in particular that I saw, which was the abortion film. But it's interesting, you talk about a form of exorcism, but what's required here is to make a good painting.
Oh yeah, and why was I naked? That was your question, wasn't it? The reason why I was naked is because I had a loathing of my physical body, and if I had a choice, I wouldn't have a physical body. I'd just be some kind of floating soul or something. I felt really weighted down by it. And also, literally, physically, I didn't feel very attractive. I've always hated my tits, always hated my genitals, always hated so many aspects of my body. So I thought, well, and also I'm afraid of the dark and afraid of being alone. And I slept here at night, not here, but when I was in Sweden, this very big sort of gallery in this very old building alone. And I was naked during the day. So I had to get over my hang-ups about my body. I had to get over my my hang-ups about being in the dark and being alone, and my hang-ups about painting, and my hang-ups about having this termination, these abortions that I'd had. So I really gave myself like 2.5 weeks of a mini hell, really.
But then the painting was a way out of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because I thought I'd be... When I first took my robe off, when I would become naked, I thought, oh, my God. And then when I first picked up a brush, I thought, you stupid cow, what are you doing? Oh, yeah, like, you're a really good artist. You come up with all these great ideas. And I thought, but you've gone too far this time. And I made the most awful paintings. Luckily, I had a mobile phone, so I was ringing people up and crying, going, I've made a really big mistake.
So the idea of being naked, doesn't it also make reference to the experience of art school, where you have naked models in rooms who are passive and don't do anything?
Yeah, of course, because I know for the people looking through the eye hole, they were the artists actually looking through the spider with the fish lenses. I know that I look like the life model gone mad, because a lot of the figurative paintings were obviously of myself, for example. So people related my body with the painting, but I was the actual one painting. And I was aware of what that was the idea behind it. I was totally aware of that. The other thing is, I went through my personal history of painting. I started with the Edvard Munch Screams. I worked up to Egon Schiele. I did an exceptionally bad Picasso painting and realised that I have a deep hatred for Picasso and loathing for him, which I never understood before. I did some Basquiat's. I did some fantastic Yves Kleins. Well, they're not Yves, they look. I did some crap Yves Kleins. And this is quite amusing. When people came into the gallery, I had no idea whether there was one person there or 100 people or no people. I could not act up to the spy holes because I'd be playing music really loud, like The Clash, for example, and I'd be drunk and so oblivious to what was going on outside of my four walls. And when I started doing the Yves Kleins, I painted my hand, pressed it on one canvas, it worked, took my jewellery off, had mixed up a big pot of blue, and then just started to paint my body. And apparently in the gallery attendant said that there was one person at that time looking through the spy hole, and there was about 40 people in the gallery. And this one person went, "She's doing an Yves Klein!" And people just started manically running and fighting over the spy holes. So, and I ended up doing about 8 or something. So, yeah.
But you didn't mind the sort of business of being on display and people...
I didn't know
watching you voyeuristically?
I didn't know whether there was anyone. I would have no idea whether there was anyone there or not. For me, I was on my own in this room.
Didn't you feel very vulnerable, very exposed? Obviously, you were exposed.
At one point, I started crying really badly about something, and then I suddenly thought, oh, God, someone could see me crying, but it was too late.
I mean, a lot of your work is to do with vulnerability and exposure, because you strip down your own person and make it available to others, and you were doing it in reality there.
Yeah, that was the other thing about being naked. Look, I really have nothing. It's not like I have nothing to hide, I really have nothing.
But you do it metaphorically in the accounts you write about your early life and Margate and so on.
Yeah, I do, so it was quite an experience for me to do it with my physical flesh.
One thing that I want to just ask you before we move out of the room, you talk about you wanted to make a good painting. What is a good painting?
Good painting is a painting I would actually hang up in my own flat. That's a good painting, full stop.
You can't say a bit more about what a good painting is for you?
For me, it's got to be aesthetically pleasing, it's got to have some strong meaning behind it, and it's got to be something which I can live with on a day-to-day basis. For me, that's what a good painting is.
Otherwise, in this room, there's the sort of the paraphernalia of making paintings, pots of paint, there's the bed that presumably you rested on, and the table full of the business of living, beer cans, notebooks, etc., etc. There's one thing that reminds me, that I'm reminded of when I come in here, which is the sort of way in which your museum is developing, that it's beginning to fill up with the sort of the paraphernalia of making, of living, of experience, and so on. When you went to Sweden, though, did you have an intention, did you have a master plan to do this, or did it just evolve?
I had a master plan, but the bit I didn't know about the plan was what literally the paintings would look like. But my master plan was actually to burn and destroy everything immediately afterwards. But then I was so confused because I'd had such an emotional, charged-up experience alone painting that I wasn't ready to destroy everything.
You've already done that, though, in your history, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. I've already done that once. It'd be very foolish to go and do that again, and that's the whole metaphor for the abortion thing. I've already done that.
This is the opposite. This is reconstruction.
Yeah, exactly. So it's quite positive, really, isn't it?
You've kind of adopted or appropriated the kind of languages of the artists you've referred to, but you've imposed your own kind of content and life over these, haven't you?
Well, this one is kind of like this is probably quite a pretty painting, but this one was Cunt International, And there, it's like, I want to fuck the world, come international. That was yesterday, but today I just want to die. But I have made a good painting, true sentiment. And that, obviously, that painting lasted over a week because it's painted over and over again of different words.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's got an abstract expressionist feel.
Yeah,
hasn't
it certainly has. I think it's the white drips, but the drips really look like sperm as well, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you've got Leeds Climb one next to it.
Yeah, but it's sad, really. I don't know why I ran to the canvas with my arms like I was about to be shot in the back or something. So they almost look like jokey climbs, I think.
They continue something that recurs in a lot of your drawings, which is this issue to do with the body, which is what you started talking about, as though you're trying to kind of explore your identity through your own physical body and physical body space.
One interesting thing, now, since I did this thing in Sweden, I've actually changed the shape of my body. So it worked personally for me, I got a lot out of it. I've become more muscular, I've lost a lot of weight, and I'm much more upright. And if you're naked, you do not walk around with your shoulders kind of all crumbled up and stooped. You tend to be much more like a warrior or something. One last thing, the spiritual starting point, my Jonathan Livingston Seagull poster from my mum's bathroom, which says something to the effect of, if you really love something, set it free. If it comes back, you know it's yours. If it doesn't, you know that it never was. And that was the first thing I put up on the wall.
Seagulls are something that really, I mean, there's a piece here which is seagulls, and you talk about when your family is cremated, the ashes are thrown into the water for seagulls.
Yeah, well, actually, sometimes it's over a cliff when a flock of seagulls flies, or when the seagulls are just flying over the sea, then we throw it into the water. Yeah.
So that's quite a poetic image, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, it is. But I come from quite a poetic family in a strange kind of way. Yeah.
So tell us about this piece called Montenegro, and there are little tanks made of cardboard with little flags above them, all located around a map of the world.
Yeah, well, the tanks are me, they're Emin, and the reason why it's called Montenegro is because, have you seen the film Montenegro, when the girl does the erotic dance with the, yeah, you have seen it, with a remote control tank? Well, I'd love to do that dance, basically. That's representing the tanks. And then there's these little flags made out of plasticine, toothpicks and masking tape and bits of cloth, which have got mono-printed names of, like, not all my friends, but most of my friends and people I know. And I've strategically placed them in different parts of the world. So if we go around the other side, I can give you a couple of examples. So, very funny one. Well, like, it's very childish, but Freeze magazine is in Iceland.
And this is on the front cover of the current Freeze magazine.
Yeah, it is, yeah. So it's quite, that's how I put them, but it's my favourite art magazine, I suppose. And then, well, for example, I put all my friends that take tons of coke, I put them in Colombia, but I won't mention their names. And
well, you've mentioned them on the little flags, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, but I'm not going to mention it on the tape, am I? Would you want me to mention
no,
it?
No.
And then other friends, I just sent them on holiday, for example, for different things. They need a break or whatever. But then I've got a friend that's always really stoned, so I put him in Afghanistan. And whatever, I'm trying to think. Oh, like, example, Sadie Coles, she always drinks at the Atlantic, so I actually put her in the middle of the Atlantic. I mean, they're just really, like, silly things, very, very childish.
But what about the flags with the match sticking out as a turret?
Oh, the enemy.
Which is you.
Which is me. Mm. Well, I think it speaks for itself, really, doesn't it? So, but also it's quite tongue-in-cheek about all the ego thing about me taking over. You know, I'm not really. It's just, it's like a toy and it's a cardboard tank. It's not going to hurt anyone, is it? It's like Soldiers of Love, maybe.
Is that a serious reference, though, about you taking over? I mean,
no, it's not. It's that sort of thing my friends take the mickey out of me on, you know. So, no, I don't want to take over anything. But it's quite weird how I've put all the tanks at the top pointing at the flags. Maybe I should have balanced it out a bit. But there we go, you know.
Here's a piece which includes, I suppose, personal memorabilia, but there's also this faxed letter from your father, who was Turkish Cypriot, and has that affected you in any way in terms of identity?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not the Anglo-Saxon woman, am I? You know, I'm definitely not. and being Cypriot, and it's not just that, my great-great-grandfather was from the Sudan, he was African. So I know people sort of think going back to your roots is like a boring pastime, but it's actually quite important to me when I was younger when I did it, because it answered lots of questions. Why am I so fiery? Why am I so vibrant? It's because I'm not this sort of like tame English girl at all. I've got a wildness in me that's definitely like hardcore Mediterranean.
Yeah, this is interesting to locate someone like yourself in Margate, of course.
That's where my accent come from.
Margate,
yeah.
I mean, another thing that comes to the surface more and more in your work is the way in which it seems to be about other people, about your relationships with other people. I mean, this is to do with your father, this piece, but you've made lots of references to your nan, your mother, your brother, of course. And I was interested in looking at your film that was made in Niagara, by Niagara Falls, the other day, and you talked a lot about the positive charge you got from the friendships of Georgina and Louise and Jane Wilson, and that seems to be very important to you, other people.
Well, it is now. I think it's probably, I'm 33, but I think it's probably the first time in my life that I actually feel confident about friendships, and I realise that a lot of my life I've been quite lonely or on the outside all the time, and I still am on the outside, but I recognise that in other people too, and then we all cling together and have a really good time. And like Niagara was really important to me for some, because I was going through a hard time and I felt very safe and very secure with those people. So that little film was like a celebration of that, really. But I want to show you my blanket.
Yeah.
Because okay. This really relates to what we're just talking about. Perhaps,
could you describe it, as people won't be able to see it?
Yeah, it's a turquoise blue sort of industrial type blanket. It's two actually sewn together. It's about 8 foot by 8 foot. And on it is a appliqued stitching and sewing with all different fabrics, with different words. And I'll read out some of the sentences. Well, basically, first of all, the blanket's called Mad Tracy from Margate. And then at the top in red, it says, yeah, we've all been there. And then next to it, it says heaven. That's the first things. The blanket, all the fabrics from the blanket are made up from my friend's clothing. Because I've done so much sewing over the last few years, I ran out of what I call sacred fabrics. Fabrics that really means to me. I don't go to John Lewis's and buy cloth. They're things like my own clothes, my parents' clothes or whatever, and I've just run out. So I wanted to make the sewing piece, so I asked all my friends to give me a piece of clothing, which they did. And there was only one mistake, actually. Someone gave me a pair of Paul Smith trousers to actually sew the button on for them, and I completely misunderstood and cut them up. That's the only mistake I made in all of this.
Where do the texts come from? You were going to read a few.
Yeah, I am. It's... Well, I wish I had my glasses on. She was heading towards the sunset, shouting yee-haw all the way. And that's like the future, that I'm going to learn to ride a horse this summer, and I'm going to Texas in the winter, and I want to be riding across the desert, shouting yee-haw. That's like my fantasy, that's like my future for myself. And then also underneath that in orange, it says, not underneath, but in the middle of the blanket, it says, she was masturbating, but I spelt masturbating wrong. It says masturbating, which people thought I'd done intentionally. And that also coincides with like the ego-based thing as well of the whole piece of work. And then there's, I'll always love you, for example, which is sewn onto Carl Friedman's shirt. And his initials are sewn onto his own fabric. There's BC, and that's shown onto Billy Childish's shirt, and there's small text pieces which explain a bit about me and Billy's relationship. And then there's a really good gay friend of mine, and on his shirt I put, yeah, I'll have your baby, because he's definitely the best candidate at the moment, and he'll know it's him because of his shirt. There's another friend who's got a fantastic sense of humour, so on the top of his shirt in yellow is shown to have a great sense of humour, and then his initials are underneath, AF. Then there's... Who else? Oh, UBK, U-Boat Commander, and that's Joshua Constant, who died last year, and I was lucky enough to be given one of his shirts, a white cheesecloth one, which I actually remember him wearing. It was actually threadbare. So that's a homage to him. Most of my friends gave me really nice things, from like Yves Saint Laurent shirts to shirts from German Street to like a fur, really nice fake fur coat. Gregor Muir gave me this fantastic yellow shirt, which I've always liked, which I would have quite liked to have worn. Lorcan O'Neill sent me the most fantastic men's underwear, which was gorgeous. Georgina gave me a really lovely sort of tartan skirt. And if you see, and what happens then, I like the clothes so much, I couldn't just cut them up. So this is where the photographs are here.
This is a whole sequence of photographs of you dressing and undressing?
In my friend's clothes, yeah. So I quite like some of the titles to go with this, yeah. You know, I mean, it's also that idea of I got the shirt off his back. And I've got a reputation for actually stealing men's clothes, only because I want the smell of men I've had relationships with, or one night stands, not one, I never have one night stands, but I like the smell of them, you know, it's that kind of thing. And I loved it with the friends who hadn't washed the stuff, because I could smell them, it was nice, comforting. Love poem.
Love poem. We're standing in front of it. Can you read it?
Yeah, I know it off by heart anyway. You put your hand across my mouth, but still the noise continues. Every part of my body is screaming. I'm lost, about to be smashed into 1,000,000,000 pieces, each part forever belonging to you.
Was it written specifically for somebody?
Yeah, it was written for Carl, actually, when I was in Geneva. My heart was actually breaking. I was missing him so much. And me and Carl have split up now, so this piece of work is called For Carl, 1993 to 1996.
So it was, in a sense, marking a relationship that had finished. But you do write a lot of poetry.
Yeah, I write lots of love poetry as well, but I don't often get the chance to show it in, like, you know, great big pink neon writing in my own, you know. So it was quite a challenge, as a, technically, as a piece of work as well.
But actual writing still remains a fundamental part of your practice, doesn't it?
I've said this to you before, you know, all artists have a kind of backbone to what they do, and mine is writing. If I don't write, there isn't going to be any art there. It's that simple.
And you said in Stuart Morgan's interview at the very end that eventually you hoped you'd live by the sea and be a writer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my dream, yeah. And through art, I might manage to be able to do that, mightn't I?
Andy Warhol, from 1963 to 1968, created a substitute dysfunctional family to preside over. The Silver Factory at 251 East 47th Street was his family home, a shimmering amphetamine-fueled workshop. With its large maroon couch and silvered interior, it became a cruising and working area for debutantes, celebrities, art dealers, transsexuals, transvestites, paranoid, failed actors, the Velvet Underground and hangers-on, the stars or superstars of his films. I'm here now with Billy Name at the ICA, where his show, Factory Photos, has just opened. Billy, a wonderful display here as we walk into the ICA of your work spread across this first wall. People really know Warhol's films from your work.
Oh, sure. When I started working with Andy in New York in 1963, it was the year he had decided he was going to resign from being a painter, so he went to Paris in a very Duchampian way, you know, announced he was resigning from painter and going to become a filmmaker. So he sort of felt he had culminated and succeeded in his art in recognition as a fine arts painter, and now was going to duplicate what he had done in painting in film, bring film to a form of fine arts that the masses could see as art films. So he bought a Bolex 16mm camera and handed me the Pentax 35mm SLR he had been using for still photography, said, Billy, you do the still photography, I'm going to start making films.
What I think is so marvelous here as well is the way you've put your own vision, and they work so well as fine art photographs now.
Yeah, because I was initially doing it as my art form, and Andy was doing his silkscreen paintings, and then the filmmaking was his art form. So being a cluster of artists, everything we did was our art form. But now, in retrospect, the work I did do has become a documented history of that era.
Obviously, there are not only works that are directly from, as you said, from setting up the films, but also portraits of the people who inhabited the factory.
The superstars.
The superstars, yes. And I wonder whether we could just talk about just some of them. I mean, first of all, are there any particular favourites here that you'd like to talk about?
Well, in terms of the people, I became intimate with everyone who was working with Andy in his films, so I was almost not noticed when I was there photographing. I was like part of the dance, and they were so used to me they didn't pay any attention. It was second nature. There were many photographers who would come to the factory, ask if they could shoot the factory for that day or shoot Andy and his work, whereas I lived in the factory. I was there every day. As soon as people came there, I was the one they saw, and to me, I was like, to them, I was like part of the furniture. So I became so intimate with them, I could catch their every nuance and their inside feelings and personality. And also I have them performing as well.
You've also got some wonderful portraits here of Nico.
Nico came to us. She had already been in Fellini films, La Dolce Vita, which I saw as a teenager. And it was a successful model in Europe, and came to the factory, and she was the ice queen with the great Nordic beauty and the straight blonde hair, and only wore either a black pantsuit or a white pantsuit. And she was obviously very intelligent and above the crowd, so to speak, but didn't speak too much. But we worked it out, so she became a vocalist with our group, The Velvet Underground. And her haunting voice lives today through the albums. And the time at the factory, she was one of our most beautiful stars. But her life went into tragic turns when she got into heroin and all of these things, you know. But she's still considered an icon of the era, and her voice is magic.
What you captured here is also people like Edie, who also got into a tragic... And they all look so wonderful and beautiful in these shots.
Well, they were at these times. At this time, they really were, too. Nico was just striking, and Edie was a pixie. And actually, in these first few years... they were absolutely perfect and charming and delightful. But as they spent more and more time in New York and engaged with the various things which we were doing at the time, like methamphetamine or whatever other narcotics, you know, the decadence sets in and you start to deteriorate and you say, oh, I only have a 3-year career.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was just like for these often very young, beautiful
debutantes? I was very young at the time, too. I was my early 20s, you know. People were always welcome, and as long as you could handle yourself, maybe you had some type of talent or special beauty, you could be in the films with us and be our friends and play with us. So we discovered as we went along what it was to have this free expression. And in the meantime, you engage with all the other things that are going on in your culture, like the sexual revolution, the chemical narcotic revolution. So all of these sidelines, the drugs, the sex, the politics, were things that were going on concurrently, and you engaged them because they were the intense lines of static or electricity or whatever. And I think we all handle ourselves pretty well. But we do have a lot of dead ones.
Yes. There's also been a lot talked about Warhol's passive gaze, the fact that he used all these baffles and that he was just a kind of silent presence. Would you say, in your opinion, that that was true? Or was he, I mean, in many of your photographs, you're documenting him actually very much active behind the camera, directing.
Well, directing, he was the director. Until the time he was shot by Valerie Solanas, he was the camera operator on every film he made. And he was a very shy person. As a personality, he was very vulnerable also, physically. He had some neurological diseases when he was very young, which made him physically very frail and sensitive and vulnerable. He was also like a black hole. If you go to a gallery, he's there, or the factory, you find yourself drawn to him, and then you fall into him and become a part of the factory, and then you come out the other end of him, and you find yourself a superstar. So you could pass right through him without him interfering, because he was definitely hands-off. He didn't want to change you. He wanted your natural talent or expression or your beauty or your specialty to be there for his films without interference. So in that sense, he was not a culture hero. He was the culture zero. He would allow you to pass right through, but still feel that electric shock and then become a superstar, hoping if he didn't interfere, he would get the best of you on film. So... Andy was someone I loved very dearly. And so, you know, to try to grasp what he was is like trying to grasp a will-o'-the-wisp or whatever. Because, you know, it would just explode in like a milkweed pod, and all the seeds would fly out and all around. And you would say, oh, where's Andy? He just exploded, you know. But it didn't make any difference because he was like a plastic doll anyway.
Another person you've documented, of course, there's a lot of photographs of her, is Bridget.
Bridget the great Bellet,
and.
Yes.
I just like you. She's such a wonderful character in Chelsea
but
Girls.
But she's also a typical New York society girl. Her father was the president of the Hearst Corporation, so they were quite wealthy. They had apartments on Fifth Avenue, and her mother had furs and rings. But Bridget was such a monster that she was uncontrollable. And her younger sister, Richie, too, they were both the same way. And they wouldn't go to college, and they wouldn't do this. They wouldn't be debutantes. And so just finding their way into the art scene. I actually met Bridget through our methamphetamine dealer, whose name was Rotten Rita, who was a guy. And he called her the Duchess Undine and I would see Rotten a lot. And Rotten would say, one day he said, oh, you have to meet the Duchess, my new best friend. You know, that's what he called it, the Duchess of New York. So we met Bridget and then brought her over to the factory. Andy had already started using Pope Undine in the Chelsea Girls, for instance. And Bridget became the other maniacal monster character. But they were both as brilliant as Oscar Wilde. You know, they had the most brilliant things to say, and they had the greatest, sharpest tongues. And they were great performers also, but they are absolutely maddening and monstrous people who would just scare the pants off everybody. People would just run out of the place if they were there and say, oh, no, they're going to tear me apart with their tongues. Bridget stayed with Andy all through the later years, and she's still around and successful in New York doing painting herself. She does breast painting. She uses her breasts as the brushes.
Some of the films have been called Minings of Boredom. Did you sit through them? Believe. What did you feel when I was there during
the making of them. We knew what we liked to do. We knew who we liked to work with. And because we were the number one hot scene in the New York art world at that time, we were setting the parameters. And there were no rules we had to follow. We had to set the rules. So in order to do this successfully, you really do have to remain spontaneous. You can't start throwing formalities at people and say, this is how Warhol does it, or the factory does it, or this is how Billy Name does his photography, and so you better do this way or else, you know, everybody said your work is crap. No, we remain spontaneous and sort of set the tone for spontaneity to be the standard.
We've got a series here of people coming out of
This is part of the bathroom series, yeah. Yes. At the second factory, I hooked it up a whole switch thing where as you walked out of the toilet, you would be flash photographed automatically. Like, here's Andy coming out. He doesn't have his shades on. This is a rare party, you know, where he's, like,
that's
squinting.
Rare, yeah.
I know. Here's Fred Hughes and Viva. So it's a whole series. And then these are just, you know, the superstars, Viva and Ultraviolet and International Velvet and Taylor Mead and Andy at the factory before we're going out to Max's Kansas City. This is just shots from Paul Morrissey's apartment. Here's the time when Larry Rivers came over to see Andy, and he has his helmet on because he rides a motorcycle, you know. And Andy's jacking on the phone as usual, so Larry's playing with Viva, and here I am sitting on the floor in front of them taking the photograph, and I'm reflected in the mirror. This is how we work every day.
But I think you mentioned to me that you didn't develop these. These weren't actually developed until, or printed until...
That's right. The,
quite
the
recently.
Negatives were developed in 1968, but I never printed them.
Some of them have been buried in time capsules. Were they the colored ones or...?
Some of them are. There are several of them here in the black and white. But if we walk to the other gallery...
Yeah, we're going to walk through to the other gallery and look at the color photographs.
The Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, for this exhibit, brought out all of my prints that they have found in the various time capsules. And they haven't even opened half of them yet, I know. They can only do like two a month because there are so many things in each box that Andy put that, you know, with their little gloves, they're excruciatingly... picking out and cataloging everything that's in it. Sometimes they find some of my lost negative strips, and sometimes they find prints. Like these, most of these, let's see, one, two, three are the only ones that are from my collection, and five or six are from the archives at the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh.
And these are the hand-colored ones.
These are the hand, they're my silver prints.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the way you made these? Because... that's such a shock to people, seeing the color.
I know.
I mean, everyone knows your work is black and white.
Oh,
and
yes,
suddenly, you walk in and they're all this colored work.
Once I did start working in photography, I was simply being an artist. I was really interested in the old way they used to hand tint photographs with those light pastel colors for a little blush on the cheek and the lips or whatever. And these are simply prints that I was making that I would have available at the factory if art patrons came over or if that people wanted to see what we were doing or if we needed a photo for a press interview or just something I thought was neat and wanted to show Andy. I would have them out in a box. And so this is when magic markers came out, the first felt tip pens. And because I was really interested in the hand coloring process, so since they're my own silver prints, I got a set of magic markers and started to color them with these very intense, deep, saturated colors. And in a sense, it's very, like, surrealistic art because I was in no way going to lightly make believe they had a little blush on their cheek. I mean, you know, I would make them orange or red or yellow or even green people. And, for instance, down here we have just a little gathering we had. It's Andy and Gerard and Tennessee Williams at the factory, you know, and they're all beautiful, deep colors. Susan Sontag and Paul Tech. And here's Andy and Edie on set of one of the, making the films, and this is the first... Batman Dracula film where the filmmaker Jack Smith played Batman Dracula for Andy with Gerard Malanga and Ivy Nicholson, Pope Undine and Chelsea Girls.
And I mean, that looks so different from the normal
I know.
Shot, you see, because
isn't
they're so
it,
moody
it,
and...
It's so, I know, and here
I think you've done it in fluorescent
I've done it in,
pink.
In saturated fluorescent pinks and yellows and greens and oranges. And, you know, being an artist, I wouldn't take exception to it. I just like brush strokes on the face. So I did it as art pieces, but they're simultaneously documents still of the people and the situations, but also documents of what I did as an artist, that I really did have the audacity to take up these techniques that no one else would even think of doing. They would say, oh, you're ruining your prints.
But when did you last see these things?
Oh, these, I saw them, probably the last time I looked at them is when I made them. Like, this says 66. And see,
I see when you saw them last year then, when they were rediscovered.
I haven't even seen these ones that came to the exhibit from the museum, Warhol Museum. It's the first time I've seen them since I gave birth, you know, like 30 years ago.
And so how do you feel?
Well,
that?
You see, I would give them to Andy, too. I'd do this, and then I'd give it to him as like a present. Now, over here, we have actual color prints from color negative film. This was only 1 year after the Silver Factory was over. The building was sold. We had to move and get a new space. We went to the black and white photography on Union Square. The front part of it was white for the office space. The back was black for the screening room and my dark room area. So this is all 1 year, 1968. And if you can find a copy of the book that Fries put out, the All Tomorrow's Parties, it contains all of this 68 color work too. So it's a good document of that 1 year at the second factory before Andy was shot by Valerie Solanas.
And why did you stop working in color?
Because of the we stopped working for one thing because we didn't know if Andy was going to live. It was a really painful, traumatic situation for us. So I basically stopped shooting pretty much. In this section, this period, I had done the third Velvet Underground album cover. And as you see, I did use different types of color films just to see what they would do. I would intentionally use tungsten film under daylight or flash circumstances, so I would get bizarre colors, again, just to experiment with the materials to see what they would bring. But when Andy was shot, see, we had almost a year there making films, some of the great films like Lonesome Cowboys, and I did the color shooting, and then Andy was shot, and everything went to a dead stop. And the whole thing just froze, and we were all traumatized, and all the art production stopped until we found out if Andy was going to live or not. It was so painful for us because Andy was always in pain for the rest of his life, and he was still bleeding from those same wounds the week before he died, you know.
Right, can we talk a little bit about that? Because there's the legend of how you locked yourself in the back room.
Well, it has to do with this shooting, actually. You see, I had my darkroom in the back of the second factory, and it was a very large space. And I had my bunk in there. I slept in there, and that was my living quarters as well as my darkroom. And I had a workspace outside, but also... But after the shooting, because the whole factor changed, the whole scene, the whole tone, the whole tempo, the whole tension was a matter of this getting over this trauma first, which took us about a year and a half just to get through the pain of all of that. So it was a different tempo. It was no longer like completely really an art scene. And I didn't feel inspired so much to continue doing all this work. So I just stopped at a certain point about 2 years after he was shot. And left the note on the door that's in Popism, "Dear Andy, I am not here anymore, but I am fine. Love, Billy."
Where did you go?
I just went out into the world. I ended up in San Francisco. I hitchhiked across the country. And that's when I started working on my concrete poetry canon. And then in the late 70s, I came back to New York and re-entered the art world scene here and called Andy and talked to him. And I've been back in New York ever since.
Okay, Billy, I just want to take you back a little bit again to the Silver Factory, because, of course, not only content with documenting it, you also, it was you.
I created it.
It
was my installation.
You created it.
It was my installation. You might say it's an opposite of graffiti. I was the first one I knew who used the spray paint cans, but I didn't do graffiti. I would do like a maximal installation. You could call it minimalism or maximalism. I would make a single apartment totally silver. I would even spray the silverware silver, and the toilet, and the telephone, and the refrigerator. But having worked in the theater, I brought in beautiful theater lights, too. So it was spotlighted like a cube. You walk into this gem-like cube, and it was a beautiful experience. And I was the one who was trimming people's hair because we didn't go to barbers as artists. there was always someone who knew how to do it just right, and I did. And an artist I knew, Ray Johnson, who was part of the Black Mountain College crowd, who really I hung around a lot with before I worked with Andy, and Andy worked with Ray, too. Ray brought Andy to one of these haircutting parties, and he walked into my silver cube and said, and because we knew each other from when I was a waiter at Serendipity, and he used to come in there as a commercial artist, we knew each other, so he could immediately come up to me and say, Billy, this is so beautiful. I just got this large loft space uptown. Would you do an installation like this in my new space? So I said, it sounds like a great idea. Let's do it.
Billy, I just wanted to also talk about the way that in the films, particularly the Chelsea Girls, mm-hmm. there's a lot of kind of violence and quite sadistic.
It's parody, though.
It's parody. Because they're not in your photographs.
No, it's not real.
The dark side isn't
really
there.
No, it's not really. Because the dark side usually shows up in action. Or if you look at some of the early Batman Dracula films, you know, there's an attempt to parody the fantastic aspects of Frankenstein and Dracula. But the Chelsea Girls thing, see, because you have Undine shooting up at the beginning of the film, shooting the amphetamine into his vein, and then this Rona comes on as he's supposed to be the Pope, and these people are coming to confess to him, and he's Pope Undine. So Rona comes in as this very sort of arrogant, know-it-all, natural-type, philosopher-type person who knows everything that's right and how everything should be, and starts criticizing him. And he says, my dear, I'm the Pope here, you know, and he says, how do you like wax her in the face? How do you like that? And she takes the first blow.
She calls him a phony.
Yes. Because you're a phony, that's right. Yeah. And he said, my dear, how do you think this is phony? You know, he comes on with his great Undine technique, and it actually is a real occurrence.
So Andy always had more people around than he could possibly use. That was always said. He copied the Hollywood system in that respect.
Sure.
Was it very competitive?
It was very competitive, but also because these are all artistic people, they're not professionally trained. You know, you're constantly in jeopardy of somebody having an overdose or something so they don't come in that day, or, you know, you don't know who's going to be actually going to show up, so we just would switch other people in who did come in that day. But, people were very unreliable. They weren't being paid, and they were just doing it as an art performance. And so, in a sense, Andy would insure himself by having a lot of people around.
And how did someone like Susan coming into the factory as a 16-year-old, and we talked a little bit about that in the beginning. How did she cope with that aesthetic?
She coped with it very well, because these people are high-power people who are so beautiful, like Edie, really couldn't live in a mundane setting. They needed an exceptional high-power thing for them to be natural, because they were so intensely beautiful and so great and beyond the regular world that a scene like this was their natural scene.
Don't you find it extraordinary how much came out of that factory?
Before we started Interview Magazine, Andy was incessantly carrying a tape recorder with him. He would always buy the best quality, and he would tape everybody all the time. It was like his walking journal. And so when we did come out with the Interview Magazine, and we did our transcriptions of our interviews, they were completely verbatim. We didn't change a thing. And so when people read our interviews in our magazine, the interviewee came to life, because you had all the mannerisms in there with no editing. Because once you start to edit, you get the viewpoint of the person who's editing. If you leave it verbatim, you get the life of the person you interviewed coming through. And it was a whole new technique. So there's the verbatim transcription thing, the multimedia show thing. There's an artist becoming a specialty filmmaker thing, and showing artists that, you know, you don't need to limit yourself to one medium. But as Duchamp said, you must get off the canvas and use the entire space. And Andy took that to heart. We would use every new technology that came out. We would want it now, right away. So it's true that the innovations out of that place are a multitude. And it's all taken for granted now, because everyone has assimilated Andy into commercial style, graphic style, fashion style, and everybody uses what came out of that era in that factory specifically as the standard or the norm now. So you don't really see it. Generations are born into it and say, well, this must be what it was always like. But it wasn't. It's factory-like.